Good evening. So, this is the Review Squared on Blaze Radio and BlazeRadioOnline.com, and it's looking like it's our final live show from the studio this semester, which...
Wow.
Cannot believe we've gotten this far. It's been a long semester. It's had its ups. It's had its downs.
Yes, it certainly has, but I know that weekly... being able to usually be here with you guys has definitely been a semester high for me. It's always been. So thank you guys for being awesome. And thank you for always tuning in to the Review Squared on Fridays at 7. Appreciate you. And I'm so excited for what we have in store tonight.
Yes, I think we have an excellent show ahead for everybody.
As per usual.
Yes. As per usual. So I'm Gideon Kariuki.
I'm John Brown.
I'm Kirsten Dorman.
And I'm Haley Svilo.
And we've got a show for you this week, as always. And yes, I'll start us off. So this week, let's talk a bit about taxes. And what for might be, this might be the last time, for now at least, invest in ed. For some background, I'm going to refer to an Arizona Republic article from this week. So last year, the state legislature and Governor Doug Ducey cut the state's income tax in the state budget from having four brackets and a top tier of 4.5% to one with a 2.5% flat rate. The tax reduction would be phased in and end at a 2.5% rate in 2024. Sorry for that. So that was actually halted because signatures for a referendum on the flat rate were submitted by a coalition of education supporters known as Invest in Ed. And for those of you not familiar with Invest in Ed, I've talked about them on the show a couple times before, but they're the group that was behind the income tax proposals that have been struck down twice and actually passed in the 20, actually got on the ballot in 2020, then got struck down about a month ago for the final time. So
for the final time?
Well, yes. It had back in 2018, it didn't make the ballot. It got removed from the ballot in 2018.
So can they never put it on the ballot again? Is my
question. They could.
Okay.
They could. Yeah. It just...
for the latest time.
The most recent time it got struck down was a month ago. The state Supreme Court confirmed a lower court decision.
Yeah, that is pretty final.
Yeah, so anyways, on Thursday, that referendum I just mentioned on the flat tax was thrown off the ballot by the state Supreme Court. The whole opinion, I really need to note, is not out yet. It is still to come. This is apparently typical of Arizona Supreme Court decisions. But the short court order that was issued said that the flat tax proposal cannot be subject to a referendum because it deals with money that provided for the, quote, support and maintenance, unquote, of the state government.
Hmm.
So that decision overturned the ruling of a Maricopa County Superior Court judge who rejected the same argument when it was made at the lower court level. What this means in practice is that Proposition 307, the flat tax referendum, is off the ballot. It will not be on the ballot in November. And the state income tax will go down to a 2.5% flat rate by 2024. The Republic article also notes that the wealthiest taxpayers will see a huge windfall, with the wealthiest Arizonans saving as much as $350,000 a year when this tax goes into full effect, and the poorest earners saving about a grand total of $4 a year. This would also be the largest tax cut in Arizona's state history. And it, for those of the unfamiliar, the flat tax actually came as a response to the Invest in Ed proposition. I'm forgetting the number of it from 2020, which when voters approved that before it got struck down for other reasons, it imposed a 3.5% surcharge on income greater than $250,000 for individuals and $500,000 for couples. And the idea was, well, we're going to, that money would specifically be directed at public schools for to boost teacher pay and boost funding. And yes, in back in March, a judge struck it down, saying it was unconstitutional. So yes, and it does look, and that was after it got knocked back, because basically what happened with InvestiNet is kind of messy. And I'm, the long story short, basically it got sent up to the Supreme Court.
Right.
They basically gave a set of criteria that forced the lower courts to strike it down as unconstitutional.
Okay.
And
so now what?
So basically now what, the InvestiNet Act, the, you know, the 3.5% surcharge, the income tax hike on the wealthiest taxpayers is dead. And so is the separate referendum done by the same people. Like, it's the same group doing both of these, but a separate flat tax referendum is off the ballot. And yeah, anyways, this ruling got denounced pretty widely. You know, supporters of the InvestiNet Act were furious. The local Democrats were furious. Interestingly enough, and I want to note this, Robert Robb, one of the conservative columnists at the Republic, also denounced the ruling as a partisan ruling. Robb is an interesting bedfellow in the opposing the Supreme Court decision here. Robb is, and I really want to note, is a conservative and pretty much denounced it as a partisan ruling, not seeing, because basically the decision came down to so there is a provision in the state constitution that if refer a budget to the referendum vote. So basically they use that rationale to strike this down, and Robb saw it as bunk, which, yeah, just an interesting person to join the coalition of people that are mad at this. I just want to note that. And anyways, so panel, I guess I'm going to throw it off to you for a second, because that's a lot. It's a mess. What do you all think about this state Supreme Court decision? So
I think I feel like this is one of those situations where I'm left with more questions than answers, because I'm still left asking, okay, now what? Does this continue to go anywhere? Can this go anywhere now? Is the Supreme Court, say, final? You know what I mean?
It's final.
It's final.
It's final. Okay. The flat tax referendum is dead. The flat tax will go into effect unless somebody gets an initiative together to increase the state income tax rate.
So then my second question is, what do these people do with all their free time now?
That's a good question. And which
what do
people
we move on to? What's the new, you know what I mean?
And, you know, are you referring to the InvestiNet coalition here?
Yeah, I mean, kind of what's next for these people? You know what I mean? Where they've invested clearly a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of effort into this cause. Now what? Because I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of somebody who's in this coalition, and you've probably dedicated now years of your life to this, and you've sort of built an identity off of this. I've seen bumper stickers for Red for Ed, you know? And so really, yeah, now what? You know, like, what do you do? You've pushed so hard, and I can't imagine how this feels from their point of view. So now what?
You know, I think that's a really good question, you know, and this was asked, you know, back in 2018 when their first, you know, income tax initiative didn't make the ballot. Like, what next? Well, they came back and said, well, we're going to do it again.
But now that they can't do that, you know what I mean? Because I think that's the main difference between that situation in 2018 and now, right? They were able to come back and say, let's put it on the ballot again. Let's try again. And now with the Supreme Court decision, as you've said, it's pretty final.
Right.
Now you can't. You know, now what?
And I really want to know, because just want to clarify, the income tax thing is a separate thing from the flat tax thing.
Right.
Those are two separate deals. Okay. Yeah. They're dealing with the same tax here, but they're doing different things and they are separate things. The income tax proposal that made it to the ballot in 2020 is a separate thing from the flat tax question here. The flat tax was referendum was in response to the legislature passing a flat tax. The income tax initiative was won on their own volition. It essentially, the legal distinction here that's important is that the income tax proposal was an initiative, as in people went, gathered signatures for a bill, and then the flat tax proposal was a referendum. It was taking a decision made by the legislature to a people's vote.
Okay.
So that is, just want to clarify, it's a little confusing.
And it is, and I think I'm glad that we're talking about it, because these are important things to know, even for you listening. Right. Where you might be like me and be like, I didn't really like have a clear what is a referendum off the top of my head. You know, I could Google it and understand it for sure. But having these conversations about these things, I think, is so important.
Yes, certainly. And Arizona has very extensive direct democracy procedures.
Yeah.
Probably some of the broadest in the country.
It's definitely one of the more involved states politically. And I don't know. This could be like a total just shift in perspective sort of thing. But I know from at least my perspective, moving from New Jersey to here, people are definitely more involved politically here. Where in New Jersey, it's like, yes, people care about what's going on. Make no mistake. People absolutely care what's going on. But things go through, I think, to votes way less. There's not the sort of same attention as broadly to what the legislature is doing.
Right. And I think part of that here is Arizona is just a politically competitive state. But the specific things going on to a vote is because Arizona does have significantly broader room for referendums and initiatives than most states in the country. Like, I know on the East Coast, most of those states out east do not even, like, referendums are extremely rare and very, very, very hard to do, and initiatives don't exist in many of the states back east.
Right. And I can't speak to the specifics of where I'm from, just because I know I was much younger, like, I was that much younger living there at 18, but, you know, I was definitely younger growing up there and didn't personally pay as much attention to what the New Jersey legislature was doing as I do now. And that could be for a lot of reasons, one including that I am now a working reporter, you know. And so it's definitely tough to say, but the feeling is certainly different.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know Jersey that well, so I can't speak to that. But
sure. I
wouldn't be surprised, just if for no other reason than New Jersey is a relatively politically safe state. Relatively. I know at the state level it can be a little complicated. But versus Arizona, which is extremely politically competitive.
Right. And I wonder, Haley or John, you're both out-of-staters as well. How does it compare for you guys?
That's a good question. I think Illinois is very, I don't know. It's so, like, sometimes I would say it's a politically, like, safe state, and sometimes I would say it's not, just because the legislature is so different, and especially since Chicago, it's a big major city, politics there are very, like, what's the word? I wouldn't say they were, like, they're very ongoing, because obviously Chicago gets a bad rap for its politicians and for our governors.
I feel like we hear
prison
about the Chicago mayor quite a bit.
Yes, yes. So I would say, I don't know. I mean, I would say just moving here to Arizona and seeing the politics here. I know I covered the aggregate expenditure cap, I think, that has to get overturned by the state legislature, I think, every year before March 1st, and obviously there was a deadline that people thought that these politicians in the legislature we're not going to overturn the spending cap by March 1st, and that would affect all of, like, Arizona public school teachers and cut, like, 16 million or I think it's 16 billion in funding.
Yeah, it was an obscene amount of money. Yeah, we talked about it a while ago, yeah. And I'm forgetting the exact figure.
Yeah, let's just say it's a lot of money that schools would lose and teachers. So no, that's a good question. I would say it's probably different in its own way. Like, it's very interesting to see how politics are done on the state level. I also think we focus too much on national level politics a lot more, which, yes, it's so important, but the state legislator can have so much power to change so many things. And for me, one of my goals is to focus in more on state legislator work, especially here in Arizona. So many interesting politicians here, sometimes for the right reasons and sometimes for the very wrong reasons.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because I think that's something that broadly we're realizing more. Mm-hmm. That, you know, change really does happen at the local and state level. Mm-hmm. And it's not enough to just know what's happening nationally.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Okay, so New York is a mess, for lack of a better term.
Sorry, I'm laughing because I see the New York political ads a lot on TV when I'm home. Can certainly concur.
And I think the biggest part of this is that people forget that New York is not just New York City. I grew up in New York City. I grew up in a very blue area. But upstate is not that way whatsoever. There are parts of upstate that are definitely blue. There are parts of it that are red. So, of course, New York is always going to be blue because there is so many people in New York City. But politically, New York is a episode that would take 3 episodes for me to explain. Everyone in New York kind of is involved and knows what's happening, because that's just kind of what happens in New York. You hear and talk about everything. It's very much a metropolitan city. It's mostly economical. So lots of tax stuff, lots of people debating over things that are worth way too much money for no reason, because everyone's wealthy and do you really care if your tax cut is 4% or 5%? Well, yeah, New York City, you do. So the change coming out here hasn't been too crazy for me, because people are still politically involved, but I'd say a lot of it's who you surround yourself with anyways. There's people who are never going to know what's locally happening in their government because they just don't care. And like John was saying, there's a lot of really interesting politicians out here, for better or for worse. But New York has that too. A lot of the New York politicians are super weird and haven't done the greatest things ever.
Yeah, you could say that. And no, Arizona does have big characters. That's the one thing I when talking to, you know, my friends like y'all who aren't from here, you know, that I get, one of the things I really, really understand is, it's like, I just say, sometimes I say things that are going on in the state. I know from some of you have gotten very interesting reactions from just the thing, from me explaining a certain, you know, politician or whatever, whoever it be, on different occasions. So Arizona has some big characters, I'd agree. And I mean, you know, I guess the way I see it, and, you know, this might sound like the ravings of a self-important resident of a state, but, you know, far from it. I think that this is just the reality. As Arizona goes, so does the country now. Like, Arizona's place on the national stage, because of a combination of the Senate and the Electoral College, make what happens here, like, very nationally relevant. So, yes. Anyways, there's a lot to be said on taxes, education, and all that. And maybe we can bring on Cammy again, and we could talk about that again. Cammy, if you're listening, we love you.
We are all Cammy stans.
Before we switch off your segment, I have a question for you. Is this, like, one of the bigger tax cuts, if not the biggest one in Arizona history?
It is the largest. Yeah. It is. Okay, that's confirmed. What
I thought. Wow. I was like, your history is better than mine on Arizona, but if I'm remembering correctly.
No, there have been some big ones, but, you know, all the reading I've done has called this the biggest tax cut in state history.
I was pretty confident based off of what you were saying earlier, but I was like, I'm not 100% sure because, like, I don't know, 100 years ago history in Arizona.
Oh, neither do I. But yes, every source I've seen on it has said that. So I'm, if it's wrong, please take it up with many other people that are not me. I'm
is simply stating what everyone else is saying, which is technically a journalist's job, but okay.
Whatever. Anyways, let me hand it off to John for his story.
Thanks, Gideon. Great segment as usual, and great job to the panel. I love the discussion. Let's move it on to the metaverse, which is a new concept for pretty much everyone, including me. So I know, review fans, I've been taking my Cronkite news stories and bringing it to the podcast, which I think, I mean, I love the stories that I do, and I think they're so interesting, and I love sharing them with all of you. So a couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to go to a press conference with Habitat for Humanity, Central Arizona, located just a couple of blocks away from the Cronkite School, and Rose Law Group in Scottsdale. So Rose Law Group, they have a team dedicated to the metaverse. They call it their metaverse team. It's like these group of lawyers that are in charge of like installing a bunch of like 3D virtual reality things and like just preparing for the new future is what I like to say. So both Habitat and Rose Law Group came together to hold a charity event in the metaverse. And you may be asking, well, how do you do that? So Habitat actually collaborated with Rose Law Group to build a house. So they have like a 3D house and you could go in and you could tour the actual house and see all the amenities that there was. You could see like the living room, the bedroom, the kitchen. And it was really cool seeing this. And they had someone who recently purchased a house from through Habitat for Humanity and with the help of them. And she was a good source. She was just telling me how the house was a nice space for them. It was spacious. So she had a really positive experience with Habitat. And so the way they held this charity gala was they would have this thing. It's called digital artwork. It's called NFTs, also known as non-fungible tokens.
NFT.
This can represent like digital artwork, music. So this is all like a digital concept. So it represents an interactive place where assets can be owned. And these assets, like NFTs, for example, are recorded on a blockchain. So think of a blockchain like an Excel spreadsheet where you store everything. So this is where everything is like digitally kept and all the records are saved. So it's like a digital ledger where you can record everything. So the NFTs, they are digital objects like music or drawings. And this is what Habitat and Rose Law Group are using for charity. So they could list like homes for like digital artwork, but can be actually represented as a home. And you can just pay with the funds, like digital currency, like Bitcoin, for example. And I found this study from Bitcoin.com that at least 18% of Americans have invested in non-fungible tokens, which is interesting because...
Wait, did you just say 18%?
Yes.
What?
So far, yes. That's only so far.
Oh, embarrassing. It's gonna keep... Sorry.
I'd imagine it's only going to go up.
It's going to keep growing.
Oh, it certainly is. And that's of all Americans.
Yes. That is according to Bitcoin.com. Don't worry, Cronkite News. I CQ'd my source. It's there.
Good job.
Can fight me on it, Cronkite News. I'm kidding.
Ahaha.
Kirsten's laugh. I suspect that's a fake laugh.
It's
definitely
a real laugh. Yeah, it's totally a real laugh. doing some quick journalist math on my iPhone calculator. So 18% of the projected 329.5 million population from our latest census, that's 59.3 million or so people who have bought an NFT.
Yeah, I think it's just,
wow.
It's so new because even I need like a glossary of all these terms because they're so new, like Bitcoin, the metaverse, blockchains, NFTs. It's like, it's just like this 3D virtual reality that no one really knows, and that's going to have an impact on the future. So this isn't Rose Law Group's first event in the metaverse, though. They actually had a meta marriage where people could get married in the metaverse, and this was earlier this year. And the meta marriage was attended by nearly 2,000 people. Wow. So you could create profiles in the metaverse. So think of it as a video game where you create a profile, mm-hmm. and obviously you're playing a video game. So like your online profile, this is actually recorded in the metaverse, and you can actually attend the wedding. And they set up this like 3D virtual reality with like wedding chairs and everything, and like a big carpet, and like a stage for the bride and groom. So just think of it as like a wedding, but online, basically.
Wow, and Zoom wedding.
Yeah, they even had an Arizona Supreme Court justice officiate the wedding, which was...
I remember hearing about that. That was Justice Clint Ball.
Yes, it was. Yeah. So Rose Law Group. So the funny thing, Ryan and Candace Hurley, who are from Phoenix, I think they had it in a conference room at Rose, and they just projected the metaverse, like the digital reality game, onto the screen, and they were just getting married, and they were there in person. I think they were with their kids too. So if you own land, you're not limited to how much you could do. So their virtual identities were recorded on the blockchain with like virtual premarital agreements. Now, this isn't obviously official and public just because it is online, but it's a cool way to say you can say, oh yeah, because you got married in the metaverse, you got married in a new virtual reality. So now this is not official in real life. You can't do this because obviously you still need a marriage certificate. But they both want to expand their efforts globally to create more innovative and affordable housing for the future, and hope that they can have some more awesome events like this. And I think tech is really up and coming. This is something that's probably going to be in our future more and more, maybe as like the next 10 years goes on. I suspect it's really going to take over our life. And that is my segment for tonight.
Oh boy. Lot going on there. I mean, NFTs are a big mess, and people far smarter than me have spent a lot of time saying they're kind of bunk. because, you know, my roommate, who is far more technically proficient than I am by a factor of like 1,000, basically the way he explained them to me, and from everything I've read on them, this seems to be correct. Mm-hmm. Like on NFTs is... like when you're buying like an NFT, right? Like one of those NFT like apes or whatever, online, you're not even buying the picture. You're buying the space that has that picture, and not even like the actual space it's stored on, just it exists like here, not here. It's a big mess.
Yeah, that's another thing. It is also a big mess. Everyone talks about all the upsides with tech, like with these new up-and-coming beginnings. But there's also that, too, and NFTs obviously have controversy to them. And let me preface this to the viewers. I am in no way a tech person. Like, I'm not, like, the most knowledgeable on it. Like, I just did my research on this for my story. So if I have anything incorrect... don't roast me, because this took a ton of research. And I was like, when I first got the story pitch, I was like, I don't know what the metaverse is. I don't know what any of this is. How am I going to explain this to someone when I don't even know what this is? So it's taken a few amount of research, but I had to preface that.
No, that's fair. That's fair. But I do think that metaverse wedding was a little more interesting. That's just one of those like, yeah, they of course still had to do the normal legal recognition stuff. Mm-hmm. But I mean, who's to say? I mean, if you have people like Rose Law Group and, you know, Justice Clint Bolick getting interested in this, I mean, how much longer until a state says, yeah, that's a legal wedding?
Yeah, I think that's where it becomes more difficult because you have to, you're crossing so many like governmental boundaries of like having a marriage be like legal and like marriage certificates and getting all the courts and the clerks involved. So yeah. I don't know how that would work. That'd be interesting to see, but I agree with you, Gideon. I think there will be a lot happening with that, and that is a big question for more people to come.
Honestly, I think it's probably bound to happen pretty soon. If you look at literally all the events that are happening in the metaverse, there was literally Absolute, who, yes, now we're going to talk about a vodka sponsor, Coachella, for a minute, held a virtual event for Coachella on the metaverse. Those companies are like very much buying into the metaverse and being like, this is what we're doing, this is the way we're going. And whether it's at Cronkite with our innovations lab or our digital audiences lab or even the Howard lab, which are, these are all the labs for anyone who's not a Cronkite student, like, what are you talking about? They are essentially, our labs are a little bit more tech based. We're all focused on the metaverse and being like, all right, how do we use this tool once it actually becomes a thing that everyone is using? And then also half of me just starts to think about Ready Player One, if anyone's seen that movie or read that book. So maybe let's not like put on our virtual headset things and then just like not pay attention to the real world anymore at all. That would be kind of rough. But outside of that, I think it's interesting, and we'll have to see how people decide to use it. And remember, that's already a thing people are using. There's plenty of videos on YouTube of just your everyday normal people who are like those of us sitting in this room, not like Zuckerberg or lawyers or high-ups, who are using the metaverse already.
Right.
Essentially, just to give you a little bit more of the science, it's just augmented reality mixed with virtual reality.
Yeah.
It's nothing too fancy. It's not stuff that like we're already not fairly used to. It's just further advancements than we currently are using, I suppose.
Yeah,
it's definitely just the concept is building off of things that have existed for a while. It's just new marketing, new, you know, like it's improved over, you know, previous iterations, because, you know, I mean, virtual reality has definitely come a long way in just the past couple of years, no doubt.
Mm-hmm. You know, you could argue that things we already have, like Minecraft or Roblox, are essentially not far off the metaverse because they're open world concepts where you can essentially do whatever you want.
Yeah, no, a lot of the same concepts that build like games like Roblox and Minecraft are similar to how virtual reality works. Yeah. It's just, yeah, implementing it in a different way and involving, instead of just you using, you know, like, your keyboard, it's now you're using different stimuli to make things move. So it's interesting stuff. I wonder how much of it is hype and how much of it is real, and I'm curious to find that out in the months and years to come. So, yeah, if that's it from you, John, I think we should take a really, you know, we should take a quick break, and we'll be back with the Review Squared on Blaze Radio and BlazeRadioOnline.com.
We certainly will.
Yes, don't go anywhere, or else.
Nothing really wakes me up like that song. The way my eyes like pop open when I hear that, I'm like, oh, right, showtime.
Anyways,
we're the Review Squared. We're happy to have you. If you're still listening to us from when we just went on break, thanks. If you're just joining us, also thanks, and stay with us. We have some more great content coming up.
Welcome.
My name's Haley Smilo, and I'm joined by, I'll say your names, John Brown, Gideon Kayuki, Kirsten Dorman.
Very kind of you. Thank you, Haley.
Yeah, I was thanks, like, should Haley. I let them say their names? I don't know. And then I looked at John, and then I was like, I'm just going to do it.
Haley's like, I'm taking over.
I was like, I don't know how things work, ever.
It's okay. It's your time to shine. Yeah. So
now I will talk to you about sports. So I want to introduce everyone to a man named Mark Emmert. Some of you might know who he is, but I'm going to assume some of you do not. He is the NCAA president, and he's been at the helm for 12 years. However, on April 26th, which was Wednesday of the Friday when we're recording this, he announced that he is going to leave his post June 30th, 2023, or when the NCAA finds someone to replace him. So, his career hasn't been the greatest. That's not fully his fault. The NCAA is a messy organization that has lots of corruption. It partially came from the man before him, but a lot of what he did wasn't so great. He caused plenty of issues, and now it's leaving the NCAA in a place where no one really wants the position. So it'll be interesting to see who takes over that position. And I think one of the more strange things about this case is that his contract was supposed to go to 2025. However, according to Yahoo Sports, it was a mutual agreement for Emmert to leave the position. The Athletic American Conference leader, Mike Arenzo, said that it's crucial that the next person who takes the job knows what the job is. He questioned, will he or she simply be in charge of dismantling the NCAA and having all the decision-making involved to the conference or the schools, or will that person be expected to transform the figurative and try to get some of these issues resolved and under control? Emmert is leaving the post in an interesting position because NIL, which, for those of you who don't know, is essentially allowing athletes to be sponsored, basically just started up, and now he's leaving. He also got into some court issues, but we're not going to go into that right now because that would take a long time. But if you want to look that up, just look up NCAA court issues and you'd see what I'm talking about.
You might be reading for a long time, though.
Yeah, that's very true because there's also lots of court issues. But essentially, he's leaving them in this interesting position where the corporate NCAA could just be dismantled and each school conference, whether that be the Pac-12, the SEC, whatever conference, they just kind of run themselves. Something interesting that the Pac-12 commissioner said of the job is that it's a unicorn and it's a really, really difficult job that he's not sure if anyone wants, and he himself wouldn't really want it.
Wow.
The Athletic wrote an article where they hypothesized, I don't think that's how you say that word, but it's okay.
Hypothesized?
Thank you. Hypothesized 10 different people who could take the job. But upon some further research, it looked like none of the people really wanted the job either. So, again, it's going to be this issue of who are they going to hire. But before we talk about who they could hire, let's talk about some of the biggest issues Mark Emmert had while he was in the job. I think the most recent one that would be in sports fans' memories is, for anyone who doesn't know, March Madness was won by Kansas this year. They are the Kansas Jayhawks. Well, when he was presenting the trophy to him on national TV, keep in mind, he said congratulations to the Kansas City Jayhawks, rather than calling them the Kansas Jayhawks. Now, that's not really problematic in terms of, like, all the other things that have gone on, but that's kind of the recent memory thing. You know, a commissioner probably shouldn't be messing up who won March Madness. That's slightly problematic. But a further problem, continuing into the March Madness bracket, is anyone who remembers last year, the women's side of the bracket was not treated fairly whatsoever. You might remember a TikTok from an Oregon basketball player named Sedona Price, who was essentially showing the weight room that the women were in and the conditions that they had and the food. And the...
Oh, yeah, I remember that. I do remember that.
We talked about that on the show, did we not?
I think we did. I'm pretty sure we did.
So am I.
Yeah.
So... I'm certain, in fact.
Mark Emmert did absolutely nothing. Essentially, instead of offering an immediate solution or rectifying the problem, he was just defiant and didn't offer any solutions. So that's just a short list of some of the things he did. He's done a lot of other things. He said that it's the quote-unquote hardest job in America, and that it being a university president is easier than being the commissioner of the NCAA.
I don't know about all that.
I would like to talk to him and ask him when he's ever been a university president in this scenario.
Or done, like, any other job.
Yeah. There's a lot of other things. He basically, for anyone who knows about Penn State, he was the commissioner at that point when Jerry Sandusky had his whole scandal. Again, we're not really going to go into that because that would take a long time. And for anyone who doesn't know about the story of Jerry Sandusky, I don't think I should be the one to introduce you to it because there's probably a lot of people who would write about it better than I could talk about it at this moment and explain it more in detail. So, like I said earlier, who is going to take over at the NCAA helm is up in question. And what we're going to do with the position is something that all sports fans and people who just generally care about college athletics will probably be on the lookout for. In January, the NCAA adopted a new constitution, which could be rewritten under a new commissioner. So we'll see what happens there. There's lots of options, and I will keep you all posted once the NCAA figures out what they're doing with the commissioner slash president spot.
Oh boy. What a mess. The NCAA, Haley, I feel like they're just at a real crossroads here.
Yeah.
Like, college athletics, you know, contrary to the most pessimistic predictions, it's not dying. Like,
no, it would never die. The revenue college sports makes is, you know, you look at it and you look at who's the highest paid state employee. Often it's the football coach or the basketball coach of a public university. There's no way college sports is dying.
No, it's doing better than ever in terms of how much money it's bringing in. I mean, it is a very heavily commercialized industry.
For sure.
At this point. And the big question, I think there's a couple of really big questions that are pretty self-evident. I think one of the biggest questions is, you know, the athletes, the student athletes here, like, yeah. what is their place in this money-making industry where they're making, I mean, with NIL, now they're making something, but that, you know.
Is it enough? Is it fair?
Exactly.
You know, I think whoever steps into the president role, unfortunately, probably isn't going to have much coordination with the athletes. Or look into their best interest. You have to remember that college sports is very much emphasizes the student athlete part. There's a reason the word student comes before the word athlete in this situation. It's not athlete student.
Right.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of the fact is, you know, the way I see it, the way college sports works is you have these, you know, these student athletes are doing labor. Like, they are doing, like,
they have to eat. Yeah. That's the way that I see it. Just like anybody else, they have to be able to put food on the table. And the way that I've argued it before, from my own personal point of view, just in general, is that they are sacrificing more time than most people to one singular thing that if they're not being paid for it, yes, usually it does pay for their school, and that's fantastic. But they also, you know, are not now able to get, for example, a part-time job the way that you could get if you had a regular scholarship, for example. And so to that, I say they should be able to be entitled to at least some income, in my opinion, because they're making so many sacrifices and because they're generating so much revenue typically for their schools.
You know, I would say personally I'm somewhere in between. I understand both sides of it. Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of issues with paying the athletes, potentially.
Oh, sure.
How are you going to compare a woman's soccer player to the starting quarterback on the football team?
Oh, sure,
without
yeah.
Title IX issues, but also, you know, the football player's bringing way more revenue
right.
than the athlete. I think there's lots of problems, and we'll see if a commissioner or president would ever be able to solve those problems. NIL is probably a good start. Women's basketball's the biggest NIL sport.
Yeah.
So that's a way for the athletes to build their own brand and set their own salary standards. Whereas the NCAA trying to figure that out, I think, would go terribly, potentially. I don't know if we trust the NCAA to do that.
I don't think anyone trusts the NCAA, period, at this point, is part of the issue here. I mean, and that's actually, you know, big question number two, after the, you know, the role of, you know, athletes and labor. I think the big question is does anybody in the, like, even just in the world of college sports have any faith in the NCAA to handle anything?
Well, I was going to mention that people are happy he's leaving this post. A lot of the athletic directors at the schools are like, yay, we need someone new. But they also don't want to step up for the role. and they're not offering any solutions. So it's like, what do you want? Do you want
to rule yourselves? Feels like a bit of a moot point.
Yeah. Do you want to rule yourselves? Which is fine. It would be okay. But, you know, if Oregon is playing Alabama, which if Oregon's playing Alabama, we have bigger questions.
Yeah.
then someone, you know, are you going to try to have the Pac-12 and Alabama, like, agree on something? That's the role of the NCAA. They're the ones who need to control things like that. There is a place for them. It's just a question of who's going to be that right leader, and are they ever going to find a right leader?
Yeah, no, I think to summarize, you know, my questions and thoughts here, it's basically the NCAA is at a crossroads. They're at a crossroads. A lot, like, they can make a lot of decisions that could really make the future of college sports extremely bright and their own future very bright. They can also make an unholy amount of bad decisions that could basically turn the NCAA into a vestigial organ of college sports. You know, basically, it exists, but nobody gives a flying crap what they have to say.
I thought you were going to swear for a second. You
know, no, absolutely not.
Idiot out of all people, that would be...
I'm the profanity police. Yeah. I can't do that.
Let Gideon be the one to slip up on air, you know?
So we'll have to stay posted and see where the NCAA goes from here. But for now, we're going to hand it over to Kirsten.
All right. And I've got a really fun short segment because I know we're a bit short on time tonight. But I thought, why not? Because it's finals week and I feel like we all need a chance to... Ooh, I just whistled a little. Sorry. To unwind. just a little bit. I thought it could be fun to do a little continuation of what we did last week. If you've been keeping up with the Review Squared at all, you know that I'm doing a little bit of an ongoing series, going on a little longer than planned, but hey, that's life. That is spring semester energy, okay? I've been up since a little before five this morning, to be honest with you.
Doing work?
I watched the sun rise, and yes, I was doing work.
Props to you.
At about that time. And so I am exhausted. And so I thought to myself, what would be fun to bring to the show tonight? And I came up with this. Last time I was here and we were talking about Elliot Rodgers, you can go back and listen to that episode. I highly recommend that you do, because we're going to, as a group, define some more. And Gideon looks nervous. But I promise it'll be fun. We did this last time and it was fun. Right, guys?
Yeah, no.
Say
I liked
yes.
It.
Yeah, I had to figure out how to find words.
Yeah,
but it was good.
Yeah.
Right. So what I'm going to do is I've got some incel terminology, and for those of you who aren't familiar, incel is a piece of terminology. And if you're not sure what it means, go back for more context to some of our most recent episodes. But it's someone who's involuntarily celibate, which, in other words, no girls. No girls?
You can't say the actual one on air.
Yeah, I can't say the actual meme on air because, as we just said, Gideon is the profanity police. But so what I'll do is I'll read the word. You guys can all let me know whether you think you have a definition or not. If you do, we'll hear you out. And if not, I will read a definition from the internet, which we all know never lies.
Yes, Abraham Lincoln said that.
Yes. Yes, but this is an internet-based community, so I feel like this is an all right source to cite. I'm CQing.
You are CQing.
Just a little bit. So our first quick term for the night is going to be the word cope. Does anyone want to take a crack at defining cope?
Well, definitely not like a coping mechanism, like, you're coping with this. Am I right?
A little bit.
I was like thinking the same thing, John. I was like,
I don't know.
Ability to handle a situation.
I was gonna say gaslight someone to I don't know.
Oh, I'm not thinking gaslighting.
No, I know what it is. Telling someone to cope in that context is basically telling them to, it's the same way people might use suck it or go, a very mean way to say go deal with it.
Right.
To suffer, basically.
Pretty much.
Really?
Yeah.
It's going along with this sort of self-defeatist mindset of, you know, they're saying, yeah, basically suck it. That's the way that it is. And you now need to deal. It's also a way of sort of accusing someone when they say something of like, well, that's just your cope. You're coping. Meaning what you're saying is invalid, and what you're saying is just your method of dealing with your unfortunate circumstance.
Like wishful thinking.
Right. So another term, this one has two forms. So it's either femoid or foid.
Oh, no, no. Okay, I'm going to let y'all guess this one.
If I'm being honest,
I feel like we're clueless.
Alternate terms are the same word.
Yeah, did your turn. We're lost.
Oh, my God. No, please, guess. I want you to take one guess.
You could take a wild guess.
Say the word again.
So femoid or foid, two different versions of the same term.
I don't even know what to guess.
I'm really just looking at, female, maybe, something with women. Mm-hmm. That's femme. There you
go. Is it like a derogatory like word for a female?
Can we have it in a sentence?
Yes, so I'll give it to you in a sentence, like a little spelling bee here. I saw a femoid in a coffee shop today ordering a latte, and I thought to myself, wow, I hate them.
They're like a flamboyant.
Maybe like a derogatory name, or like not like a nice name for someone. I don't know.
So you're really close. It's a derogatory term, and it's a sort of a derogatory euphemism for women. Instead of calling us women, these people, like incels, will call women femoids or foids. It comes from the sort of term female humanoid or female android. It's basically meant to insinuate that women are subhuman, or basically to other them.
Oh my gosh, I've never heard of these terms before.
Yeah, I'm
using actually some pretty popular ones from the community. These are terms used very often in online incel communities.
Oh, wow.
That's a wreck.
Last time we defined alpha male, you should go back and listen to that episode.
Yes, which is still being edited. Sorry.
It's okay. As soon as it's out, you can follow us on Twitter.
Yes, you can.
For more of this content, and to be updated when we put out our other episode where we'll conclude the arc of my incel series that I'm very excited for, because we're going to go over a very infamous example of someone who is inspired by Elliot Rodgers and people like him. So you really, really should keep an eye and an ear out, but I know we're running up on time.
Yes,
so I'm
going
to hand it back to Gideon. Thanks, guys. See, I told you this would be fun.
It was definitely fun, I will say that.
Get a little giggle out of it.
Anyways, this is our final live episode of this academic year. We're going on summer break. We're all going our separate ways. And
yes.
It's a bummer. I'm going to miss the Bill Austin, and I'm going to miss you all. You all are still all around here for another week. And Haley, you live here, so. Anyways, I just want to thank everyone who's been listening to us for the past 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And we're still going on. We're going into our third year as a show, unbelievably. And we'll have some stuff for you definitely in the early part of the summer, no doubt. I mean, Kirsten still got to finish up her series. So if nothing else. But until next time, you can follow us at @review_squared on Twitter. And thank you so much. Don't tune in next Friday. We will not be on air. We will be doing other things.
But let us know if you recognized any of the terms that we defined tonight. I'm super curious.
So for the last time in studio in the spring of 2021...
2022.
Yeah,
Gideon,
okay,
Gideon.
I'm going right
no
up here. Good night.
2021.
Good night. Good night. Goodbye. This has been the Review Squared. I'm Gideon Kariuki, and I don't know what year it is, apparently.
'The song at the start of the episode is Dedicated to the Press by Betty Davis, and the music you hear is by Springtime.